This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's community access radio station Plains FM 96.9 and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
It's time for Bookends.
Kia ora, welcome to Bookends with Maureen Rout and Ruth Todd. I've been away and you've been holding the fort for me, Ruth.
Well, it was good to be back.
Yes, exactly.
So you went away, I got
filled
better.
Filled in. So what have you got for us today?
Well, two really good books. First fiction, first novel from a person I had never heard of before, Sue Younger, Days I Like Grass, and a fascinating murder story of the Burgess Gang in the 1860s, murder on the Mangatapu and between Nelson and around Havelock and Pelorus, which I'd used to be around that area. And it's just fascinating and very clever Burgess Gang, and especially Burgess. And Wayne Martin has written that.
Christchurch writer.
Yes, he's written quite a lot of historical stuff and he makes it read like fiction. It's well worth reading. Wayne Martin is a Christchurch-based writer, history enthusiast and mechanical engineer, and his articles, usually destination pieces with a strong historical backdrop, have appeared in all kinds of magazines. In 2009, he won the South Island Writers Association Suffrage Cup for a short memoir, and in 2013, he wrote The Corporate History, Strengths of Strength, the 75-year-old history of Powell Fenwick Consultants. Welcome to the program, Wayne.
This Thank you.
New book is quite different from any of the other ones you've written, isn't it? Or have you written some articles about this place before in magazines or anything?
Never written anything of this type and never really even touched on crime particularly, although it's long been an interest of mine in terms of the sort of thing I want to read. So, it was quite a new thing.
Well, this narrative history of the Burgess Gang and their greatest crime, murder on the Mangatapu.
It's the track between sort of Pelorus and
that's
Nelson.
That's Pelorus, I was trying to think of. We used to live up there and I should know. So 1866 was when all this happened, but there was a big build-up to it before that, wasn't there?
Yes, certainly. The gang had a lot of form, obviously starting in the Australian goldfields where three out of four of them were transported there, and then they were sort of formed part of this network of criminals that moved around the gold fields, and a lot of them migrated to New Zealand. And they started off in Dunedin in 1862. So,
And Burgess, Richard Burgess, was the most notorious one in the group.
Yes, and he was very much a leader type of person, obviously quite charismatic. And it's a common thread through his sort of history is that he ran the show and he was a blowhard and a braggart and he liked to dominate other men and he just seemed to revel in that role.
Mm. Yes. Was the one or who did you like the most? Or does Burgess stands out a mile? But there's always Sullivan who I hadn't read anything about before.
Yes, Sullivan had sort of a lesser profile in history than Burgess, for sure. And that was one of the interesting things, was actually digging up stuff about Sullivan. In Archives New Zealand in Wellington, there's a file about 2 inches thick on Sullivan that covers his all his various petitions to get out of jail and all that kind of thing. But in terms of looking at the four men and who's the most interesting,
They're
reluctant to use the word favourite because you wouldn't you wouldn't associate with any of them, obviously. But Burgess was the most sort of compelling.
Yes.
There was something about
He could have
him.
Gone straight, couldn't he? I mean, he could have been a very successful
He could have.
Man.
And he had several chances in his life to go straight, you know, when he was doing well on the goldfields and that kind of thing. And one of the, I think it was the phrenologist who sort of read his bumps, et cetera, and had a bit of time with him, who said that he could have been a great soldier or explorer.
He was fearless.
Totally fearless, yeah, and, you know, fiercely intelligent. I mean, totally misguided, not wise, but, yeah, just so much sort of human potential there that's just misdirected.
And he was with Kelly when he was in this area, who wasn't a great, well, he was a follower, I suppose. He did what Burgess
very much so. Yes, they were best mates, but,
And Levy.
He's the biggest enigma of the lot, really, in that he came across to Australia originally as a free migrant, and he was a trader, shopkeeper, that type of thing. But he all had this sort of sideline where he was a bit of a consultant to the underworld, and he also followed the goldfields and sort of profited by aiding criminals and taking his cut.
That's
if you
right.
like.
Yes. Yes. Those three were hanged eventually.
Yes.
and Sullivan confessed, and so did Burgess. I found that strange, strange that those two actually confessed.
Yes.
And then Sullivan sold the beans to
exactly
the authorities, and so he wasn't hanged, and Richard Burgess was pretty upset about that.
Yeah, and that, like the existence of the two confessions is something that kind of makes this a bit unique. It's very unusual.
Yes, I wondered that.
Yeah, and I mean, Sullivan's was, you know, motivated. You know, he saw the placard that they put up that, you know, anyone not an actual murderer would get a pardon. And so he seized his chance. And, of course, then Burgess's confession was a retaliation to that, in that he wanted to see Sullivan hanged and he wanted to save his two mates, Kelly and Levy, by concocting this story that they were already well on the road to Nelson when the murders happened.
So it is really a whodunit, isn't it? Because there's doubts about who was actually there, or is it pretty obvious that it was Burgess and co?
Yeah, well, it is a whodunit to the extent of participants in certain murders.
Yes.
It's interesting, like, Sullivan and Burgess were both extremely detailed in their accounts, extremely detailed, and they dovetailed for the most part. But then there's the participants. It seems like that Sullivan had sort of substituted Levy mostly for his role in a lot of the stuff. So there's a strong suspicion that Sullivan was more involved than he let on, for sure.
I didn't like him as much as I like Burgess.
No, well, it's a strange thing. Burgess is very compelling. Sullivan is just,
not but an important sidekick sort of to Burgess, isn't he? Because Burgess probably admires certain qualities he's got, but he went off him when he was a traitor, really.
Yes. Mm.
It felt clear from your research that Burgess would never have done that.
No. Burgess was ruthlessly faithful to his criminal mates. That was just one thing that came through his whole book, that he's utterly faithful to his criminal friends.
I was fascinated that Dobson had been killed by them, you know, that I never think
George.
Of Dobson.
No, he's a bit of a forgotten victim in some ways.
Yes, so it was interesting that he came into the story. Yeah. And then Sullivan was finally pardoned.
Yes.
Wasn't he about 1874, I think, 75?
Yes.
And went back to London.
Yes, yes. He was shipped across to London. I mean, they'd tried various things of getting him away. They tried to get him to America and things like that. But, of course, the ship's captains would recognise him seemingly quite, even though he's disguised invariably. They seemed to get onto him reasonably quickly and he'd been thrown off various ships, but eventually he made it to London. Actually got recognised halfway during the voyage. But
did you meet any descendants of Burgess when you were researching this?
No. And, I mean, that's one of the big sort of questions for me. Something I'd like to research a bit further was the fact that he, his mistress in Hokitika was pregnant.
Yes.
And the sort of time of birth we'd expect, I think, sort of October, November 1866. So, I mean, I went through and I tried to locate all the births in the grey district and tried to match them against the birth, deaths, the marriages, etc. But I couldn't actually match the two records. There's more work to be done on that, but it is possible that Burgess has got descendants. And that would be a fascinating
angle. Amazing, wouldn't it? Mm. Yes. Mm. So he knew the legal system too, didn't he? I mean, he had a tremendous knowledge of...
Yes.
And his mother had read to him and, yes, you know, he'd read books. He read the Bible when he was in prison.
Yes, very much so. Yeah, he seemed to know the legal system inside out and, he took to defending himself typically.
Right.
And he did very ably in the Mangatapu murders, and also his cross-examining of Sullivan was quite skillful as well.
Mm. Yes.
Yeah, for a layperson, you know.
That's right,
yes.
Who'd had no chance of doing anything like that. And Kelly murdered a lot of people too, didn't he? He was pretty quick to...
Yeah, well, that's certainly the suspicion that between him and Burgess they disposed of a lot of people, particularly on the West Coast. And His specialist skills seemed to be strangling... sort of the windpipe, latching onto the windpipe and, horrendous detail.
Oh, yes, it must be.
In this story, but yeah.
So this was their greatest crime?
Yes, yep.
Why? They did so many.
Well, the thing is that there's only five known and documented and, historically accepted murders. So don't say five, there's six, including Dobson. So the murder of the Deep Creek merchants was killing four people, in one go. That's what kind of elevates it to higher than.
How long
of the
did
others.
They take to find the bodies and sort of know it was the Burgess gang?
So it was reasonably quickly, the suspicion fell on the Burgess gang because they kind of stood out. They're sort of, pretty shady-looking characters. And the thing that they went into Nelson and they thought they had probably another week up their sleeve that they could just, buy clothes and whatever. So they made themselves a bit conspicuous, but they didn't realise that Henry Moller, was following the Deep Creek men and who was looking out for them and who immediately found out that they just disappeared into the ether. So he raised the alarm in Nelson. So they thought that they had at least a week because these men were going over to the coast and, communication times being what they were. So they made themselves a bit conspicuous. And so suspicion fell quickly on them. In terms of searching for the bodies, I think it was a good week or a couple of weeks before they found them.
Well, it's an amazing story. I was just thinking it would make a wonderful film.
Yes.
Wouldn't it?
Yeah, it would. And everyone says that.
Yes, you need to get onto it.
Yes, I got, in fact, a friend in Mosgiel who actually put me onto this story in the first place.
Oh, I'm glad they did, Wayne, you've done so well. You've done it brilliantly. You've obviously got the background and the enthusiasm. And if people like whodunits. They should look at the real one of the real ones of our own South Island. And
And I was going to say that the friend in Mosgiel has been badgering me to write a screenplay for it.
Amazing.
I just need to find the time,
A narrative history of the Burgess Gang and their greatest crime, murder on the Mangatapu, is written by Wayne Martin in Christchurch, and it's published by Canterbury University Press. Just grab it and read colourful, very colourful history at the Gold Rush Times. Thanks very much, Wayne.
Thanks very much, Ruth.
Good.
And join us, Maureen Rout and Ruth Todd, next Tuesday on Bookends on Plains FM 96.9.
A few hours after Yossi asks her to marry him, Claire hurries to theatre for an acute trauma case, a three-year-old hurt in a road accident. A man, obviously the father, stares at her as she walks through the bright aqua corridor. He's slumped against a doorway, horror in every muscle, rubbing his eyes, his daughter's blood on his shirt. The accident's his fault, she can tell straight away. But she can't talk to him now. She leaves him to the garish cutouts of Mickey Mouse. She slices the wee blonde girl from nipple to navel, and it's messy and bloody and slippery. Surgery takes absolute concentration, observation, logic, and experience. That's all she has at a time like this. There's a lot of bleeding in the tiny abdomen, and Claire is soon blood spattered. Every body is the same, but every body is different. Claire had been amazed to realise early on in medicine that each person's internal organs are as individual as their faces. Children as young as this take real dexterity, skinny baby birds, no room to move. Even working out what is what inside a belly is an art. Never share that with parents, though. They're sure it's pure science. Claire pokes her fingers deeper, locating the bowel, looking for the source of the bleeding, trying not to think about the father outside, unravelling, no doubt. He hasn't had a chance to ask anything or understand anything. She'll talk to him as soon as he's finished. It was Dad's first access visit since the separation, says one of the nurses. Oh, God, says another. Quiet, please, Claire says. Running her fingers along the bloody loops, she thinks she finds something. Leaning right in to see the delicate meat in her hands, her cheek is almost brushing the skin on the child's belly. There it is, another tear. She shows it to her registrar and nods to him to start stitching.
That was Sue Younger reading from her first novel, Days Are Like Grass. Now, that's a fascinating title. Tell me about the title.
The title was really hard, actually. I'd never expected how hard it is to name a book. But the title comes from a psalm. It's not a religious book, but, you know, as you know, the Bible is full of beautiful imagery and beautiful language. So it comes from Psalm 103, and it is relevant to the book because one of the characters, Yossi, comes out with it at a particularly poignant moment when someone has died and no one knows what to say, and he just sort of whispers a psalm. As for man, his days are like grass, as a flower of the field, so he flourishes. And it's got overtones of sort of carpe diem, seize the day, you know, life's short, it's very brief, and so I guess brings up some of the themes of forgiveness and forgiving and forgetting that are there in the book.
Well, good choice. So,
thank you.
So, Sue, you've got a lot of characters in here. I really enjoyed this book because there were so many characters and so many really good characters. Sometimes there's one good character, and you've got you read the piece about Claire, who's come back from London with Yossi, who's from Israel, and he was keen to come. She wasn't so keen to come because there's a lot of unfinished business, isn't there, in New Zealand?
Yes, there is. There's a mystery that dominated Claire's childhood to do with her father and whether he committed a very infamous crime or not. And so Claire's way of coping, she is very resilient, but her way of coping has been to run away, push it all down, get on with her own life. So she's very reluctant to come back, thinking that New Zealand being as small as it is, that'll all come up again, and sure enough it does.
And she's so protective, isn't she? She's wanting to protect everybody, and I understood that as I got further into the story because she hadn't really been protected.
That's right. She's very guarded. So I've had different reactions to her. Some people don't like her. Some people like her very much. I think there's, like all of us, there's the surface Claire, who is sometimes quite cold and guarded and businesslike. She's absolutely mad on her job. You know, her job is everything to her. But I think, as the novel unfolds, you realise that she's involved in that job because she's desperately trying to protect a whole lot of children, as you say, as she wasn't protected from the world. So she cares deeply about those children. She can be very blunt and very seem quite difficult, but inside she's a sort of vaguely hurt little child, really. Just, you know, her whole guardedness is to not face up to threat. She's looking for threat everywhere.
And this is the way she copes.
Yes, the way she copes and her kind of resilience, you know, and that is one way for people.
That's right.
To not go there. You know, everyone assumes, Yossi and everyone else desperately wants her to face up to this past, you know. And I quite admire her myself, the way she has chosen to cope by just refusing to get dragged down by it all.
Yes, me too. I also admire her role as a paediatric doctor, medical person, and she throws herself into that work. She does amazing work with children. And yet, in the domestic situation, she doesn't cope so well.
Yes, that's right. And that's a very deliberate choice on my part, that because her father was, in fact, convicted and then pardoned, which is very topical at the moment with David Bain and Tina Fora, and I couldn't have known that was going to come up when I wrote the novel, but because of that, she's had not knowing things swirling around her, you know, gossip, innuendo, rumour, not knowing when she's a child whether her father was guilty or not. And I think that's given her this passion for facts and evidence, evidence-based medicine, you know, which she takes almost to a fault. She loves the work because it's science and it's, you know, and it's real, it's tangible, it's physical health of the children. She feels a little way less comfortable, but sometimes is drawn in to the sort of family dynamics and the caring for an entire family, and sometimes they don't treat their children perfectly. You know, she feels way less comfortable with all that side of medicine.
That's right. So her father is in hospital now, and mm-hmm. and older, of course, since she's come back. And she works with the abused children. But then we have Roy Mata. You sort of do them very cleverly, the relationships. There's usually two people and perhaps a third, but, you know, Roy Mata is Claire's 15-year-old daughter, and then there is Rachel, who is Roy Mata's father's sister, yes.
Sister, that's right, yeah.
So those are all very strong characters. I mean, Claire's the strong one there, but Roy Mata is a strong 15-year-old, isn't she?
Yes, she is. Roy Mata came about, I actually met a guy over in Europe. I met a lovely man who was Māori, who came from Tōrere, in a, you know, little tiny place in the East Coast, and lived in Germany and had two daughters with a German woman. And I thought, what's it like to be those girls? You know, have this, what is identity anyway? You know, you look Māori, and they had Māori names, and but they spoke German, and their mother was German, and their whole life experience was German. So anyway, that got me thinking. So Roy Mata is a 15-year-old. She's always lived in London. She's never been to New Zealand, but she gets brought back. And of course, in London, she's somewhat anonymous, but here she's Māori. There's no doubt, you know, when people see her. And so then I had to find a way for that whole secret to come out. Claire has kept the secret of Roy Mata's conception to herself. Nobody else in the world knows, you know, who the father is and how it happened. And that has to come out too. So, you know, here we are in New Zealand, 1.5 steps of separation. And so along comes this aunt who works out, puts two and two together and works out who Roy Mata is, which I think is quite believable in New Zealand.
Very believable. And also, I liked the way you developed that theme. And, you know, we looked at a relationship where the father, living in Germany, and comes back to see the daughter. And Claire doesn't want that.
You know, and I think I was working a lot with that whole thing of family identity, you know.
Yes.
Māori culture, at least, you know, from the outside to me, is so based in identity and family and whakapapa and genealogy. And, of course, Claire, as a Pākehā, is completely at a loss about that. She completely denies who her family is. She won't even see her father. She doesn't want to. It's all about shame and guilt and difficulty. So I loved that kind of collision, if you like, of cultures, where Waimata suddenly has a chance to find out this wonderful, rich source of who she is. And Claire, of course, feels terribly threatened by that.
Yes, she does. So this is what you've done so well. You've put these characters onto the page, and they really come alive. There's not one character there that I wouldn't want to know more about. You know,
I think
it was Michael Gifkins who wrote on the back of the book, "I defy anyone to discard it without getting to the end. It's closely observed and vivid." And it is. There's no way I couldn't not finish that. Almost at one sitting, I wanted to know what was going on, what was going to happen.
Yeah.
And so that's a huge achievement, for a first novel, to have so many great characters and have them all...
Thank you.
And they're all interconnected. You've done that so well.
They are, and they're all, you know, there's sort of themes, but I'm trying to get them to come out through a really good story, you know, that you don't want to finish.
Oh, it's such a good story. Yes.
That was my aim, to sort of, you know, you can't put down. I wanted to make it really accessible and really readable and not be able to put it down.
Well, congratulations, Sue. Sue Younger has written Days Are Like Grass, and it's published by Unoya, that's right, who are doing some very good work. And so look for it. It's out in the shops now, and I just loved it. And it's one of the best novels I've read this year. So congratulations, Sue.
Thank you so much. That's great.
And join us, Maureen Rout and Ruth Todd, next Tuesday on Bookends on Plains FM 96.9.